When you buy LG, you get so much more than just an appliance. You get more done, more cost savings, more peace of mind, and more control. Because LG appliances are designed to do more. Like washers and dryers with AI tech to take out the guesswork. Refrigerators that fit in tight spaces and keep food fresher longer. Or ranges with precise induction cooking and easy cleanup built in. All with the style you want. And reliability you can count on, so you can get more from your home every day. LG appliances, so much more. Make life easier with LG. See the latest models and savings now at LG.com.
Welcome back to Evolution of a Snake. I'm Zach.
And I am Madeline.
And this is a very special episode of Tay Rewind, your favorite series where we take a specific moment in Taylor's history and we zero in on it and we analyze and we say, what the hell was happening? Madeline, what are we zeroing in on today?
So today we are looking at an article from October 15th, 2015. It was a GQ article. Maybe you've heard of it. I personally find the photo shoot to be quite unforgettable. In many ways. So I'm sure a lot of people are like, oh yeah, that photo shoot. It is a little article entitled Taylor Swift on Bad Blood, Kanye West, and How People Interpret Her Lyrics.
This is one of the last times that she ever allowed herself to be perceived by someone else in a specific way. And to be more particular about what I'm saying, Taylor didn't really let people write profiles of her after that. The next profile that we got, basically, where she allowed the person writing it to editorialize a little bit, was her Time magazine profile when she was the person of the year. And that was very stage managed. This is actually, when you read what the writer is interjecting and how he's making the connections between what Taylor's saying and what he knows about her to be true, it's a really interesting synthesis that he gets to come to. And this is something that, like, later in her career, Taylor has rejected. She doesn't like being put in a situation where her words can be taken and analyzed as something outside of the context in which she says them. And it came at a very interesting moment in her career because she was literally on the precipice of everything falling apart. It hadn't quite happened yet, but she was definitely careening towards losing control of everything.
It's also really interesting because there's actually a part in the article where the writer says that something that she said was bullshit. It's not even hyperbole. He said that was bullshit. What she just said was bullshit. And I was like, oh, this is so delicious. Yum, 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 yum.
And it was.
We don't get stuff like that anymore. And it was bullshit.
Was.
And he was right to say it. But this is the kind of stuff Taylor, I hate to use the term allow, like she would never allow this to happen today, but she doesn't. This is kind of, when you get to a certain part of being like, or a certain point of being like so big, you don't have to just let people say that what you're saying is bullshit. He was correct, but it's not about being right anymore. It's about, listen, this is the way that I want to be presented, and I'm Taylor Swift, and I think I have the right to ask to be presented in this way. And she does. That's all there is to it.
And she does, but the art of the celebrity profile is dead because celebrities have realized that they don't have to give access like that to other people's opinions anymore. And like celebrity profiles are specifically where a lot of careers have derailed. Famously, John Mayer, was it for Playboy or was it for Rolling Stone? I can't remember. One of the most demented pieces of nonfiction journalism ever. He walked himself into it. Here, I find the writer does a really good job of being respectful about what Taylor is and does, but also interrogating a little bit. Even if she is not giving him the answers that he needs, he comes away from it and like thinks about what she said in the context of what he knows about her. And I just find that way more interesting than a profile that's just everything is great, Taylor's happy, and I love her.
It is a lot more interesting. I think that there's like a perfect middle ground between like the expose tell all, or like I'm trying to get you. I just did a deep dive on the 2003 Diane Sawyer interview with Britney Spears. That's an example of I'm trying to get you. I'm going to put you on the spot. I'm going to slut shame you. And I'm going to sex shame you, et cetera, et cetera. Diane Sawyer got it really bad during Free Britney and kind of deserved. And then there's, of course, this is total fluff and nobody can ask me anything. And you can only ask me what I want you to ask me. There's a pretty good middle ground between the two. I kind of think this article is a really good example of a good middle ground because it's not like a teardown piece. He's not getting her, but like she was talking bullshit and he said, this is bullshit.
He's clocking her on her tee. And sometimes Taylor needs to be clocked on her tee because she will just say stuff. And a lot of the times, I think, when she gets challenged in a format like this, it is helpful, I think, to people's understanding of her. It doesn't make her seem out of touch because it allows you to filter her, your perception of her through someone else. But with that, all that being said, we're going to get into it. We're going to read the article to you as though you've never read it before, which I'm sure you haven't, because this is something I don't see talked about very often. We mention it quite a lot, but
well, there
we're
is
ready
like
to
a lot of
dive in,
like lost Taylor media, and it's not literally lost. Like so much of the stuff is like accessible, but like nobody talks about it anymore. People forget the magazine article used to be a very delicious peek into the lives of celebrities, and now we don't get that anymore.
The only peek. It was the only peak. And I would take this over a TikTok. I really would.
Oh, any day of the week, ladies and gentlemen. I miss these kinds of magazine articles so bad. They were so delicious.
Another great one for the record books is The Saddest, Baddest Girl in Rock, Lana Del Rey's 2012.
Oh, yes.
Rolling Stone.
I did an episode on the Liz Review about that. That one was
2014.
Crazy. It was
really crazy.
So good. Yeah, it was so
Lana
good.
Was being herself.
She was on her behavior, and that's what made it so entertaining. I like the behavior. I like the behavior. What do you want me to do?
And Taylor was on her behavior here, too. Here she is. Let's just get right into it. "That's a pap," she says as we leave the restaurant, pointing toward an anonymous gray car that looks like the floor model in an auto dealership specializing in anonymous gray cars. Her security details suggest that it's probably not a paparazzo because there's no way a paparazzo could find us at such an unglamorous, unassuming establishment. But as with seemingly every other inference she has made, Taylor Swift is ultimately proven right. The guy in the gray car is taking her picture. This annoys her, but just barely. It's August in Southern California. We crawl into the back of a massive Toyota and start driving to Swift's West Coast residence, located in a rural enclave in Beverly Hills. The gray car trails us through Franklin Canyon. Swift whips out her phone and starts showing me images from the video shoot of Wildest Dreams, including a clip of a giraffe licking her face. She has more photos on her phone than anyone I've ever met. "I wanted this video to be about the making of a 1950s movie being filmed on location in Africa," she says. Swift came up with the concept after reading a book by Ava Gardner and Peter Evans, The Secret Conversations. Her premise for the video, co-starring Clint Eastwood's son, is that since social media did not exist in the 50s, it would be impossible for actors not to fall in love with each other if they were isolated together in Africa, since there would be no one else to talk to. When you hear it sounded out like that, it's so, yeah.
It's delusional. Mm-hmm. It's just delusional.
It's really delusional.
Right? So smart. Nobody's ever come up with this before.
And what does that have to do with Wildest Dreams, is the question everybody's asking.
It doesn't. And that's what I've been saying since day frickin' one. It has absolutely nothing to do with it. Is the wig gorgeous? Sure. We like a wig. But it has nothing to do with anything. She thinks she's Meryl Streep in the video, too. She really thinks she's giving out of Africa.
This was a period of time where she was just not being challenged at all. And also, I think it's interesting to note when this is being said. This is, like, I would say, probably at the apex of 1989. Like, she's almost done with the tour. She's got every celebrity in her phone wanting to be there on stage with her. She's at a very positive career moment. So she goes on. So this is how the article continues. "We chat a little about Ryan Adams and about books. Swift mentions that she wrote a non-autobiographical novel when she was 14 titled A Girl Named Girl, and that her parents still have it. I ask her what it was about, assuming she will laugh, but her memory of the plot is remarkably detailed. It's about a mother who wants a son, but instead has a girl. If she released it today, it would immediately be the best-selling YA novel in the nation. When she was about that same age, Swift's family moved from Pennsylvania to Nashville to jumpstart her music career. I ask what she imagines might have happened if they'd never moved and if she'd never become an artist. I would still be involved with music in my spare time, she says, but I would have gone to college, and I probably would be involved with a form of business where words and ideas are at the forefront, such as marketing. She returns to her phone and starts scrolling for an old voice memo she sent to Jack Antonoff of the band Bleachers while they were co-writing songs for 1989. His nickname for Swift is Dead Tooth, a reference to a minor dental mishap. Just as she tells me this, her cell phone rings. The display panel says the incoming call is from J. Timb. Oh my God, Justin Timberlake. Her surprise does not seem artificial. Can I take this?
Boo.
The crowd boos.
I always forget, this is a piece of Swift lore that maybe a lot of people have forgotten. Taylor's biggest celebrity crush ever, she claimed, was Justin Timberlake. Good for her.
She did claim that consistently for a long time. I will give that to her. She stuck with that for a really, really long time. He surprised her on the Ellen show, and now he's calling her on the phone. I mean, it's gaggy.
it's gaggy to her. I'll tell you that for free.
Gaggy to her.
It's gaggy to her. She takes the call. The volume on her phone is loud enough for me to intermittently hear both sides of the conversation. Swift explains that she's driving to her house, but she can't actually stay there because contractors are renovating almost every room. Have you ever seen the movie The Money Pit? Asks Timberlake. She has not, so Timberlake provides a capsule review. He has a four-month-old baby at home and is constantly tired, yet he can't fall asleep. He asks Swift for advice on sleeping. Swift tells the driver to pull over to the shoulder of the road, since she keeps losing reception as we drive through the canyon. The paparazzo in the gray car casually passes, having not so casually followed us for at least 5 miles. The conversation lasts almost 15 minutes, which is a little weird, since I'm just sitting there beside her, openly taking notes. You're never going to get old, Swift assures Timberlake. That's scientific fact. That's medical. Even her sarcasm is aspirational. Eventually, JT tells her the reason he's calling is because he wants to perform the song Mirrors with her on the last night of her upcoming 5-date stand at Staples Center. Late in every concert, Swift brings a surprise guest on stage. She reacts to this news the way a teenage girl in Nebraska would react if suddenly informed that a paternity test had revealed Taylor Swift was her biological sister. When she ends the call, Swift looks at me and says, "This is so crazy. This is so crazy." She repeats that phrase 4 times, each time with ascending volume. There was a time when a phone call from Justin Timberlake was this big of a deal, girls. I know it's the year 2026, and this is going to ruin the tour, and he's been put in the pokey, but there was a time when he was kind of a big deal. So the writer says, "Now inside my skull, I'm thinking one thought. This is not remotely crazy. It actually seems like the opposite of crazy. Why wouldn't Justin Timberlake want to perform with the biggest entertainer in America to an audience of 15,000 people who will lose their collective mind the moment he appears? I'd have been much more surprised if he'd called to turn her down. But then I remember that Swift is 25 years old and that her entire ethos is based on experiencing and interpreting how her insane life would feel if she were exactly like the type of person who'd buy a ticket to this particular concert. She has more perspective than I do. Every extension of who she is and how she works is in indeed, quote-unquote, so crazy. And what's even crazier is my inability to recognize just how crazy it is." Interesting.
So Taylor Swift is right again, he says. I think the writing in this piece is really good, first of all. Like, it's a very engaging read from start to finish. But it's true. And this is something that a lot of people struggle with and notice about Taylor when they're analyzing her character, is how happy and enthusiastic she seems when exciting things happen to her. And it's always crazy to me that people find it so hard to believe that she is like naturally just like kind of giddy and optimistic about things like that. She loves attention.
And they hated her for it, lest we forget the surprise face. I'm saying let her cook. Let her cook.
Let her be surprised.
Something that I actually never forget about, this is like way back in the day. I think this was like Fearless era, or even like before the Grammys, where she won all the Fearless Grammys. So like 2009 Grammys, maybe, she was one of the announcers of the nominations. And when she got nominated for something, I can't remember what it was, she like went around and like hugged everybody and, "Oh my God, this is so excited." And then that fucking asshole, Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters, like when he got nominated, he like ran up and like mock pretended to hug everybody to like make fun of her.
I hate you.
We don't forget these things. We don't fucking forget these things. And Courtney Love has always been right about you. She said it from day one. You're a leech.
She wasn't right about Taylor, but she is right about you.
She is right about you. She wasn't right about Olivia Rodrigo, about Taylor, about most other women. But she is right about you, Dave.
When it comes to men, she's right.
When you buy LG, you get so much more than just an appliance. You get more done, more cost savings, more peace of mind, and more control. Because LG appliances are designed to do more. Like washers and dryers with AI tech to take out the guesswork. Refrigerators that fit in tight spaces and keep food fresher longer. Or ranges with precise induction cooking and easy cleanup built in. All with the style you want and reliability you can count on. So you can get more from your home every day. LG appliances, so much more. Make life easier with LG. See the latest models and savings now at LG.com.
So the article continues. If you don't take Swift seriously, you don't take contemporary music seriously. No, period. With the arguable exceptions of Kanye and Beyonce, she is the most significant pop artist of the modern age. The scale of her commercial supremacy defies parallel. She sold 1 million albums in a week 3 times during an era when most major artists are thrilled to move 500,000 in a year. If a record as comparatively dominant as 1989 had actually existed in the year 1989, it would have surpassed the sales of Thriller. There is no demographic she does not tap into, which is obviously rare. What's even more atypical is how that ubiquity is critically received. Swift gets excellent reviews, particularly from the most significant arbiters of taste. A 2011 New Yorker piece concluded that her reviews are almost uniformly positive. She has never gratuitously sexualized her image and seems pathologically averse to controversy. There's simply no antecedent for this kind of career. A cross-genre, youth-oriented, critically acclaimed colossus based entirely on the intuitive songwriting merits of a single female artist. It's as if mid-period Garth Brooks were also early Liz Phair minus the hat and the swearing. As a phenomenon, it's absolutely new, and this somewhat predictably creates a new set of problems. I really chafe at the mid-period Garth Brooks with early Liz Phair. What is, you're just saying stuff. This is Rob Sheffield.
Yeah, and I do find that a lot of people who were writing about Taylor, like a lot of these articles, try to like make her like a hodgepodge of other artists. She's like, if Joni Mitchell was Lana Del Rey, and if Lana Del Rey was SZA, it's like these ridiculous like patchwork quilting of like who Taylor Swift is. And I get it's a way for like perhaps like the older generation to like be able to understand who Taylor Swift is and like how it all works and all that kind of stuff. But it's like, I don't really care about them, and I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
This is GQ also. You're not talking to old people. This is for
the young, hot people of the world. The thing that bothers me about this particular section of the article, she has never gratuitously sexualized her image.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what And what if she did? Then what?
That's not really relevant. Yeah, that detail being thrown in, it's a man's observation, first of all. But that's also not relevant to, he's trying to say, I think, in this entire passage, like, there's no precedent for someone like this. And part of that seems to be, and she's not a whore.
And she's not Britney Spears. She keeps her top on, ladies and gentlemen. It's like, okay.
And they got her anyway. This is what you don't realize. Top on, top off.
Exactly. They're going to fucking hate you anyway. This is what I'm always telling the girls. You will become Chun-Li even if you try to be the perfect girl. You're Chun-Li. It doesn't matter. So you may as well get your tits out. Yeah.
That's what we're saying. Yeah.
This is one of the most exciting times of the year to be a pop music enjoyer because it is officially concert season. Olivia Rodrigo's festival is coming up. There are some Lana Del Rey shows coming up, and Noah Kahan is currently touring as well.
And if you're looking for the best deal on tickets to any of these upcoming events, look no further than today's sponsor, SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the number one rated ticketing app with more than 700,000 events currently listed, including concerts, festivals, and even sports or the World Cup, if you care.
SeatGeek is the first place that I go to find tickets. It's where I bought my tickets to My Chemical Romance's Halloween show at the Hollywood Bowl. And every time I use SeatGeek, I know that I'm getting the best and safest deal for my tickets.
And that's because SeatGeek rates each ticket on a scale of 1 to 10. Green dots mean good, red dots mean bad. Plus, every ticket is backed by their buyer guarantee, so you don't have to worry about showing up empty-handed on show day.
To make your concert season as good as it can be, you can use code SNAKE10 for 10% off your SeatGeek tickets.
That's 10% off tickets with promo code SNAKE10. Make sure you click the link in the description to download the app and have the code automatically applied so that you can use it later.
Thank you, SeatGeek.
He goes on then to deliver a really clocky assessment of Taylor that I think still holds to this day. He says, even with the most high-minded considerations of Swift's music, there is inevitably some analysis or speculation about her personal life. She's an utterly credible musician who is consumed as a tabloid personality. Very often, and not without justification, that binary is attributed to ingrained biases against female performers. But it's more complicated than that. Swift writes about her life so directly that the listener is forced to think about her persona in order to fully appreciate what she's doing creatively. This is her greatest power, an ability to combine her art and her life so profoundly that both spheres become more interesting to everyone, regardless of their emotional investment in either. Swift clearly knows this is happening, but she can't directly admit it because it's the kind of thing that only works when it seems accidental. She's careful about how she describes the process because you don't become who she is by describing things carelessly. This immediately brought to mind the tortured goddamn poets department, because that is one of those albums that reaches the logical endpoint of this, where you do have to think about her life at least a little bit to understand what she's talking about. And in fact, the more you understand about her life, the better the album is. Like, the more context you have, the more you can appreciate what's being done.
Mm-hmm. Very true. And that's why I feel like so many people really can't cook into the Tortured Poets Department, because they're not understanding how good the prophecy is, because they weren't there for the Dear Reader. They weren't there for the, you know, all the way back in the day to a song like Invisible. They weren't there for this, that, and the other thing. You're never really going to be able to fully get, or even Clara Bow. Like, you're never going to be able to fully wrap your brain around that if you're not tuned into the lore. I mean, sometimes it feels a little weird to describe Taylor's career or, like, things that happened in her life as quote-unquote lore. But when that has been kind of mythologized in your work, it kind of is lore. Even when we only look at what we have in terms of the text, there's so much lore there to uncover and mine. I don't even have to look at anything in her actual life. All I have to do is look at what's in the text. That's all I have to do. And there's so much there. Some people aren't willing to do the work. And that's why they're not getting TTPD.
They aren't. And I think a lot of people are like, well, I don't want to do homework in order to listen to something. And I'm like, well, the homework that you're speaking of is really just listening to her other albums and contextualizing the current one with what you've known before. You don't need to be reading PerezHilton.com to understand what's been going on. You don't even need to go on Twitter. It's all there for you. I think that makes her a really unique and interesting artist. But it also, I understand it really presents a dilemma where, like, Tortured Poets to me is one of her best albums ever. But when I'm like, if I really took Swiftie out of it, would I still think that? I don't know.
I think you have to be a little Swiftie. And in that case, it begs the question, is it that good of an album if you have to be Swiftie to get it?
This is
But then again, you see, is it so bad to have self-referential work? I mean, I wish I could really bring up, like, a classic great artist who constantly referenced themselves. Maybe, like, an Andy Warhol or something like that. Like, everything is a reference. A Banksy. I feel like Banksy is always referencing himself. Is that less of an art just because you have to know this to understand that? I'm asking.
No, it's a great question. It's a great question. And as a reviewer, if you're not clicked into at least a superficial understanding of the lore, are you equipped to be handling the music review?
Say it. Many people are not asking themselves this question. A lot of people are putting their fingers to the keys and they've never even streamed Speak Now.
No, and it's like, if you didn't stream Speak Now, your opinion on Tortured Poets Department is completely irrelevant.
It's irrelevant. And that's just my take and I'm sticking to it. And I know everybody listening is clapping and cheering and saying, you're so right. And you should say it again. Thank you guys so much for the W's in the chat.
As Thank you for the W's. I think a great creative challenge one day will eventually be to, like, come up with a reason why the Tortured Poets Department is an incredible album if you put the lore aside completely. And it will happen.
Yes. And it will happen someday. Get ready. Because this video is going to blow your freaking
somewhere.
Mind. Somewhere. I don't know who.
I'm not saying me.
They're out there somewhere. All right, everybody, to continue. So now we get into this kind of part of the interview where he's kind of asking her questions or presenting her with something and she's directly responding. So he says, even the most serious critics inevitably discuss the more tabloid aspects of your life. Is this valid? Does the fact that you write about yourself in such a confessional style require intelligent people to look at your music through that lens? And she says, I don't feel there is any injustice when people expand beyond my music and speculate on who certain songs might be about. I've never named names, so I feel like I still have a sense of power over what people say, even if that isn't true, and even if I don't have any power over what people say about me. The fact that I've never confirmed who those songs are about makes me feel like there is still one card I'm holding. So if you're going to look at your life and say, I get to play sold-out football stadiums all over the world, I get to call up my favorite artists and ask them to perform with me, and most of the time they say yes, I get to be on the cover of this magazine, this is all because I write songs about my own life. So I would feel a little strange complaining about how it's covered. This is back when she wasn't complaining, lest we forget. She's not supposed to complain.
No complaining, no giving up the ghost. He also is correct that she can't directly admit this because otherwise it kind of says the jig is up.
Yeah. He goes on and he asks, but I'm not asking if it's fair or unfair. He's kind of challenging her a little bit in this moment.
Oh, he's clocking.
He's clocking. I'm not asking if it's fair or unfair or if the downside is worth the upside. I'm asking from an aesthetic perspective. Is thinking about your real life an essential part of appreciating your music? Could your music be enjoyed the same way in a vacuum, even if no one knew anything else about you? Taylor says, Shake It Off is one of my most successful songs. And that has nothing, this kills me, directly, intricately, pointedly personal in it. No one really says I stay out too late. I just thought it sounded good. I want this tea clocked.
That she flopped.
Is
she
about you flopped. Directly. Taylor. That, nobody Taylor. Else could have written that song. Taylor.
No. She, come and on. You know what? This is why it's so funny to see her having to, because a lot of the time she gets the soft PR question. She does her spin, her Taylor spin, and then it's next question. They don't follow up. She tried to do her spin on him and he legit said, you're not no. answering my question. My question is it an essential part of your music to think about your life? And she said, Shake It Off doesn't Shake have off. Any specific lyrics about me. It's such a stupid
no answer.
No answer
and I'm whatsoever.
I'm cheering. She refused to answer it twice. And she thought that she answered it here, but really she didn't. Because, Shake It Off can be enjoyed in a vacuum, sure. That's one song.
Let's hear more. Can style be enjoyed in a vacuum? Can blank space be enjoyed in a vacuum?
Well, and the thing is, I think also that question is kind of dumb. Can they be enjoyed in a vacuum? Really, it's can they be understood in a vacuum?
Period. Exactly. Would you be able to wrap your brain around such a concept as topical for the time? 1989 is like a bad example, I'm realizing. Like maybe I Know Places. Could you really fully grasp I Know Places if you didn't know that this was about Taylor Swift? I guess you could, because you could be thinking, okay, if you were an LGBT person listening to the song, you'd be like, this is how it feels, and I'm not out, and this is kind of the way that it feels as, you know, somebody trying to be in love. I guess maybe I'm saying she's right.
You
right.
know
Shake It Off exists. Shake It Off exists.
Impossible to understand in a vacuum is like 90% of Showgirl. Imagine being in a vacuum and hearing Wishlist. What the hell is that about?
Well,
who
you know
is
what?
This? Why are you so mad?
I'm inside the vacuum. I'm directly inside the vacuum, and I still don't understand what's going on in Eldest Daughter. Like she really. It's like that Richard Sykin quote where he says like sometimes you get so close to somebody you wind up on the other side of them. That's what happened in Eldest Daughter. I'm like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. I
whatever
guess I
you said,
much. Whatever
was said.
You say. So he goes on. Have you ever stopped yourself from writing a fictional lyric because you feared it would be incorrectly applied to your non-fictional life? She says, no. Some of the things I write about on a song like Blank Space are satire. You take your creative license and create things that are larger than life. You can write things like, I get drunk on jealousy, but you'll come back each time you leave because, darling, I'm a nightmare just like a daydream. That is not my approach to relationships, but is it cool to write the narrative of a girl who's crazy but seductive but glamorous but nuts but manipulative? That was the character I felt the media had written for me. And for a long time, I felt hurt by it. I took it personally. But as time went by, I realized it was kind of hilarious. It's impossible for an artist to control how she is perceived. But an artist can anticipate those perceptions, which is almost as good. A nuanced sense of humor does not translate on a general scale, Taylor says. And I knew that going in. I knew some people would hear Blank Space and say, see, we were right about her. And at that point, I just figured if you don't get the joke, you don't deserve to get the joke. Clock it.
And it's that's so true. That's so true. But I think the preceding line is much more interesting. It's impossible for an artist to control how she is perceived, but an artist can anticipate those perceptions, which is almost as good. And some might say that being too much in anticipation of what people's perceptions are of going to be of you was the undoing of her in the original 2016 downfall. She expands on this later too.
She does. I think that this is everything that she said is pretty true, and everything that he said was true as well. I think they're both kind of right on this section.
They're clocking. They're both clocking, and I'm cheering and I'm clapping. You see how challenge can bring a really interesting result? I liked it.
I like to read it. I like that I'm reading it right now. I have to tell you the truth.
So the article continues. There's a long tradition of musicians expressing or pretending to express a degree of disinterest in how they are metabolized by the culture. They claim to ignore their own reviews while feigning a lack of discernment about what their audience wants or expects, since these are things that cannot be manipulated. Swift is not like this. She has an extrinsic focus that informs her creative process. From her perspective, not tracking how people view your work feels stranger than the alternative. I went through a few years where I just never went online and never looked at blogs, she recalls. This was around 2013, when the only thing anyone wanted to write about me was about me and some guy. It was really damaging. You're thinking, everybody goes on dates when they're 22. It's fine, right? Nope, not when you're in this situation and everything you do is blown out of proportion and expanded upon. All of a sudden, there's an overriding opinion that doesn't accurately reflect how you actually live your life. So I didn't go online for a year and a half. I actually forgot my Instagram password, but now I check in and see what's happening. In 2015, that stuff does matter, because if enough people say the same thing about me, it becomes, in the general public's mind, a fact. So I monitor what people say about me, and if I see a theme, I know what that means. I've had it happen twice before. In 2010, it was, she's too young to get all these awards. Look how annoying she is when she wins. Is she even good? And then in 2013, it was, she just writes songs about guys to get revenge. She's boy crazy. She's a problematic person. It will probably be something else again this year. Probably. I thought this was so interesting, because back in the day, it used to just be, yeah, there was one overarching thought or sentiment about her that would appear at a time. Now it's like there are 80 at any given moment.
Back when I used to defend Taylor with my sword on the internet day in and day out, I remember one that was like a really, really big one for years was the, all she does is write about boys. All she does is write about boys. And I would be on my steed typing out,
the best day.
Well, what about this song? This song isn't actually about boys. If you understood anything about songwriting, then you would understand I'd be doing that day in, day out. And that was like the one thing that I had to defend her from. And then it was, she can't sing. And I was, you know, fingers to the keyboard. And then it was, she's a serial monogamist. And it was keys to fingers to the keyboard. Now it's like, there's so many things. If you can think of it, a horrible accusation that you could lob at anybody, it has been lobbed at Taylor Swift. And it's happening right now. It's happening as we speak.
So I really wonder how tuned in she is to the sentiment now, because I think at this point, there's no point trying to stay on top of it. It's simply too much. And it seems to, she has this kind of delusional sense that if she knows the theme, if she knows what people are saying, she has control over it. And that's just so not how that works. And she was about to learn that lesson in a really hard way, where she tried to stage manage the fuck out of Snakegate. And that made everything worse, because the real thing that people were uncomfortable with about her persona was that she was calculating.
And there's really something about like 1989 Taylor, 2014, 2015 era Taylor, where you got the impression she really thought everything was under control. She was like, I've got it locked down.
Or that she could bend the world to her will.
Right. And that didn't happen.
Mama, there's a storm coming.
Mama, oh honey, you got a big storm coming.
You got a big storm coming. So the article continues, how you view this level of consciousness is proportional to how you feel about Swift as a public figure. There is a perpetual sense that nothing about her career is accidental and nothing about her life is unmediated. Those are not unusual thoughts to have about young mainstream stars, but what's different with Swift is her autonomy. There's no Svengali directing her career. There is no stage mother pushing her toward the spotlight. She is in total control of her own constructed reality. If there was a machine that built humans out of positive millennial stereotypes, Swift would be its utopian creation. I used to watch Behind the Music every day, she says. Her favorite episode was the one about the Bangles. When other kids were watching normal shows, I'd watch Behind the Music, and I would see these bands that were doing so well, and I'd wonder what went wrong. I thought about this a lot, and what I established in my brain was that a lack of self-awareness was always the downfall. That was the catalyst for the loss of relevance and the loss of ambition and the loss of great art. So self-awareness has been such a huge part of what I try to achieve on a daily basis. It's less about reputation, management, and strategy and vanity than it is about trying to desperately preserve self-awareness, since that seems to be the first thing to go out of the door when people find success. There's like a lot of mental illness going on in this. A lot.
And it's the least self-aware paragraph in the whole thing. That's what's crazy. That's what's crazy about it. She really is like, I am incredibly self-aware, you guys. I know exactly, like, I do. And it's like,
No, I really get it. I'm with you.
No, like, I'm in your head. And it's like, and that's how I know that you have none whatsoever at this exact moment. And that's okay. You know, it's not a moral failure to get lost in the sauce a little bit. It's totally fine. But she really thought, she genuinely was like, I understand what people think about me, and I am in control of this narrative now because I am self-aware, and nobody gets to decide what my reputation is except for me. And it's like, well.
So that's not true. And also, the latest missteps, I would say, in her public image, a lot of that has to do with a lack of self-awareness. You could call a song like Cancelled not very self-aware.
You could. One could say it's not very self-aware to release so much terribly made ugly merch and so many variants of the album when this is the thing that people are critiquing the fuck out of you for and being like, more. It's like, okay, so that's, you're doing the thing where you're forgetting.
And also, it's one thing to be self-aware. It's another thing to decide what you're going to do with that knowledge. Right. Like, you can know what you're all about, but are you using that information to change anything, or are you doubling down? It's interesting.
It's interesting to think about. And again, I mean, what do you think was Taylor's most self-aware time?
I'm kind of saying Red, because she was a little fed up with the way that she was being perceived, and she felt like it was unfair, but she wasn't out there trying to correct the narrative every 5 minutes. She saved that for 1989. But with Red, she was kind of like, I'm listening. I'm hearing what you're saying.
I also think Lover was a complete moment of delusion, if you think about it.
That complete lack of self-awareness. That was amazing. Incredible.
I think maybe Folklore wasn't bad self-awareness. I think it was just like, I'm putting this out there because this is what I want to put out there. But in general, I do kind of think there, you know what I mean? I'm not going to say it,
there's such a thing as being too self-aware.
There's a little something going on there. There's like a disconnect. But that's okay. I'm rooting for the anti-hero. I always have been.
No, it must be exhausting. I'm exhausted. Anti-hero.
I'm exhausted. No, it's exhausting. And I'm happy every day. I'm blessed with
anti-hero is a great example of self-awareness that goes nowhere.
Yes. Actually, I was almost going to say, I was kind of thinking maybe Midnights. There's a lot of self-awareness on Midnights, actually. Dear Reader.
Oh, very self-aware.
You should find another guiding light.
Very self-aware.
Ooh, that's interesting. Midnights Revisited.
It's coming, girls.
It's coming,
girls. It really is coming.
All right.
The advantage of this self-focused fixation is clear. Swift is allowed to make whatever record she wants based on the reasonable argument that she understands her specific space in the culture more deeply than anyone around her. The making of 1989 is a prime example. She claims everyone at her label, the Nashville-based Big Machine, tried to persuade her not to make a straightforward pop album. She recounts a litany of arguments with various label executives over every possible detail, from how much of her face would appear on the cover to how co-writer Max Martin would be credited in the liner notes. As far as I can tell, Swift won every one of these debates. Even calling this record 1989 was a risk, she says. I had so many intense conversations where my label really tried to step in. I could tell they'd all gotten together and decided we got to talk some sense into her. She's had an established, astronomically successful career in country music. To shake that up would be the biggest mistake she ever made. But to me, the safest thing I could do was take the biggest risk. I know how to write a song. I'm not confident about a lot of other aspects of my life, but I know how to write a song. I'd read a review of Red that said it wasn't sonically cohesive. So that was what I wanted to do on 1989. An umbrella that would go over all these songs so they all belonged on the same album. But then I'd go into the label office and they were like, can we talk about putting a fiddle and a steel guitar solo on Shake It Off to service country radio? I was trying to make the most honest record I could possibly make, and they were kind of asking me to be a little disingenuous about it. Let's capitalize on both markets. No, let's not. Let's choose a lane. A fiddle and a steel guitar solo on Shake It Off is absolutely sending me.
No, and it actually reminds me of, like, when they would make country versions of her poppier songs. And
oh,
it
we
would
are
be
never
the
country version.
Most heinous thing you've ever heard in your life. Like, what were you thinking? Scott Borchetta?
That also shows that he like doesn't really understand what country music is, because you can't just put country instruments on I Knew You Were Trouble and voila, it's a country song. That was never going to happen. But this is, again, this is more evidence for our relationship with Scott Borchetta, more fraught than anyone even knew or we understood at the time. The fact that they pushed back on everything, and I forgot that they challenged her on how much of her face should be on the cover, because it was like, what, her nose down and there were no words. It was TS 1989. She really easily could have, I guess, tried to get both markets, but she was right to say, no, let's pick a lane.
Yeah, she was 100% right. And history has shown that. And it's surprising to me that even after this massive success of 1989, I feel like probably there were still battles and there were still arguments during the Reputation era and during the making of Reputation. I feel like they still were like doubting her in so many ways. And it's like, but after and it's like 1989 wasn't just a success. It was like at the time, the biggest success of her career. And you doubted her and you're still going to doubt her even after all that. It really just goes to show men don't know anything. They're saying, let's put a steel guitar and shake it off. That's why you're not behind the boards. That's why.
It's interesting that the writer is not really making the connection between Taylor is known to be this artist with so much agency and is in total control, and yet she's facing these very intense battles behind the scene. I guess because she always won, it seemed like they weren't hard battles to fight. But I think we really don't understand how much they tried to fuck with her creative intuition.
No, I mean, we can only know what she tells us and like how much she says. It's like, I get the but I would like to know more. That's why I'm saying I'll never get tired of hearing more and more songs about the master situation and Scott Borchetta and all that, because I find it so interesting. And she always has more to say about it. And it's still not stale or tired to me. So gimme. As long as she wants to write about it, I will be pressing play.
Thank you. And debut TV is coming. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. The article continues on. Like almost all famous people, Swift has two ways of speaking. The first is the way she talks when she's actively shaping the interview, optimistic, animated, and seemingly rehearsed, even when that's impossible. The second is the way she talks when she cares less about the way the words are presented and more about the message itself, chin slightly down, brow slightly furrowed, timbre slightly deeper. The first way is how she talks when she's on television. The second is unequivocal and less animatronic. But she oscillates between the two styles fluidly because either A, this dissonance is less intentional than it appears, or B, she can tell I'm considerably more interested in anything delivered in the second style. This is really interesting stuff. It was very, like, he really was, like, paying very close attention. And I think maybe when she read this, she was like, oh, that would be something that I would think.
Observations that she doesn't like to be like, made about her, especially because he's going on to talk about her being calculating. This is setting it up in a way where it's like you can see in her physical body that there's a version of herself that she wants you to see and a version of herself that she's a little bit less guarded about. That makes her seem very calculated.
Calculated. And speak of the devil. Late in our lunch, I mentioned something that happened several years ago. By chance, I'd found myself having dinner with a former acquaintance of Taylor's who offhandedly described her as quote-unquote calculating. This is the only moment during our interview when Swift appears remotely flustered. She really, really hates the word calculating. She despises how it has become tethered to her iconography and believes the person I met has been the singular voice regurgitating this categorization. As she explains these things, her speech does not oscillate from the second mode. Am I shooting from the hip? She asks rhetorically. Would any of this have happened if I was? In that sense, I do think about things before they happen. But here was someone taking a positive thing, the fact that I think about things and that I care about my work, and trying to make that into an insinuation about my personal life. Highly offensive. You can be accidentally successful for 3 or 4 years. Accidents happen, but careers take hard work. And he says, here we see Swift's circuitous dilemma. Any attempt to appear less calculating scans as even more calculated. Because Swift's professional career has unspooled with such precision, it's assumed that her social life is no less premeditated. This even applies to casual, non-romantic relationships. Over the past 3 years, Swift has built a volunteer army of high-profile friends, many of whom appear in her videos and serve as special guests at her concerts. In almost any other circumstance, this would be seen as a likable trait. Leonardo DiCaprio behaved similarly in the 90s, and everyone thought it was awesome. But it's somehow different when the hub of the wheel is Swift. People get skeptical. Her famous friends are marginalized as acquisitions, selected to occupy specific roles, almost like members of the Justice League, the ectomorph model, the inventive indie artist, the informed third-wave feminist. Such perceptions perplex Swift, who is genuinely obsessed with these attachments. I honestly think my lack of female friendships in high school and middle school is why my female friendships are so important now, because I always wanted them. It was just hard for me to have friends. Where do you begin?
We gotta pause. Things keep happening. Okay, so let's return to the conversation that they have about this acquaintance. So when I read this, I was like, I could see the journalistic issues and interventions going on here because we're missing a lot of context about who this person was that said it to her and what the context of what they were saying she was being calculated about is. Because he doesn't specify whether the person he was talking to was saying calculating in a way that was pertaining to her career or her personal life. The way that she responds to this seems as though it was applied to her relationships. That's what I'm thinking, is the person was saying she's calculated in her personal life, like who she dates, because she wants to write songs about them. That's what I would assume was said. But I'm sure there were moments where he couldn't say what the acquaintance said or give any more context because off the record. Taylor also probably said, this part of it is off the record. You can quote this part. That's how I imagine this like answer came together, because it's so disconnected from, it's missing a lot of pieces. Here was someone taking a positive thing, yes, that you care about your work, and trying to make it into an insinuation about my personal life. See, we don't have the information or the context on that. You can be accidentally successful for 3 or 4 years. They happen, but careers take hard work. So I'm like, the article goes on to talk about Katy Perry later, but I don't know that this is necessarily Katy Perry that he's referring to. I think it might not be.
I don't know, actually, because like my memory has only left behind one impression of why she hates calculating so much. And that memory is only Katy Perry. Like, that's the only thing that I can remember, is Katy Perry once said this. So I'm sure it wasn't, honestly, an unpopular thing for people in the industry, perhaps, that somebody like this GQ interviewer would know.
It's true.
It wasn't a mystery. It wasn't a secret that, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I do think the specific way that it seems like calculating was used, I don't think that that's a fair, like, that's what she's upset about. And like, that's actually fair that she is, because calculating in business is not the same thing as calculating in relationships. Calculating in relationships is like your fucking Lex Luthor from Superman or something like that. Calculating in business is like, you know, your Steve Jobs.
Being smart.
Hey, man, I'm the cool guy. Like, that's kind of what it is.
Even she conflates the two here, because she says, you said this thing about my personal life that's very offensive, and then immediately pivots to, my career is hard work. Accidents don't happen. So that's what I'm saying. I would love to know more context about what this person said and why they said it and why it's rubbing Taylor so bad the wrong way. But either way, she's right. Am I shooting from the hip? No. And she has said in the future, not too long after this, that she really regrets acting like all of it was a happy accident, behaving like she wasn't at the boardroom sitting there making decisions, because that is the reality. And I think she thought that if she showed that she worked hard for it, that it would make her seem even more calculating. But I would argue, I would counter with her, it looks more calculating when you're not honest about what's going on behind the scenes.
Well, this is, and then when he says, any attempt to appear less calculating makes you seem even more calculating.
it's literally golden handcuffs.
It really is, like, it goes in a circle and a circle and a circle. And he's right. Like, this kind of does come off like she's a little bit calculating. I've always found it interesting that that word is offensive depending on who you apply it to. I think is kind of interesting. Because it's not a bad thing if you say, ooh, who's a really good example? It's not a bad thing if you said somebody like in his
heyday.
What?
She's always complimented for being calculated. No one.
I just wasn't expecting. No one works harder than her. I wasn't. Okay. No. You're right. You are
gotcha.
So right. No. She took the, you know, Kim sex tape. As a mother, I was horrified. As her manager, I was cheering. Yes, that actually that's a really good example. Kris Jenner is Kim Kardashian. Is incredibly calculating.
Katy Perry is very calculating too.
With Taylor,
to be a person in the public eye, you have to think about what you're doing.
The thing about Taylor is that I think because of her little, I'm just a little girl. I don't know. Oh, I'm so nice. Ooh, it seemed disingenuous and like calculating to actually be like, ooh, I'm pigtailed. I don't know anything. And then like behind the scenes, like actually you're controlling everything. It makes you seem disingenuous. And so I think that's probably what people were responding to during this time period. I don't think people would say Taylor's calculating today in a way, like obviously she is and it's like not a secret. I don't think people would say it as like a huge insult today. Some people think it's a clock. I'm saying, well, Beyonce's calculating too. It's called counting the money, baby. That's what you're not getting. Beyonce, mm-hmm. Jay-Z, you know, Selena, Rihanna, all of the most successful people in music, they're calculating. It's not a bad trait. Anyway, I feel like we've regurgitated this so many times. I'm like, I'm saying the same shit I've said a million times.
No, but it's interesting. Anyway. It has context. And then she goes on. This is like the Taylor greatest hits, things I am afraid of, my greatest fears, and things that keep me up at night. Because she goes on to talk about being unpopular in school. Popular people often claim they were once unpopular. So I asked Swift for a specific example. She tells a story about middle school when she called several of her peers on the phone and asked if they wanted to go shopping. Every girl had a different excuse for why she couldn't go. Eventually, Swift's mother agreed to take her to the local mall. When they arrived, Swift saw all of the girls she had called on the phone goofing around in Victoria's Secret. I just remember my mom looking at me and saying, we're going to the King of Prussia Mall, which is the big, big mall in Pennsylvania, 45 minutes away. So we left and we went to the better mall. My mom let me escape from certain things that were too painful to deal with. And we talked about it the whole ride there and we had a good time shopping. The incident appears to be the genesis for a verse in her 2008 song, The Best Day, a connection she doesn't note when she tells me the story. A cynical person could read something into this anecdote and turn it into a metaphor about capitalism or parenting or creativity or Pennsylvania. But in the framework of our conversation, it did not seem metaphoric of anything. It just seemed like a very real memory that might be more internally motivating than any simplistic desire for money and power. This, to me, is one of the most astute clocks of Taylor's actual motivations for why she does her behaviors, her money pleas, her everything. And I've said this multiple times. If the way to get power and to be successful and to avenge her enemies was not by making money, she would do that other thing, whatever it is. It just so happens that we live in this world. But it's so, like, the amount of clocks that are going on here. He's saying she shares this anecdote and she doesn't herself make the connection. Oh, I wrote a song about this. This is part of my lore.
When you buy LG, you get so much more than just an appliance. You get more done, more cost savings, more peace of mind, and more control. Because LG appliances are designed to do more. Like washers and dryers with AI tech to take out the guesswork. Refrigerators that fit in tight spaces and keep food fresher longer. Or ranges with precise induction cooking and easy cleanup built in. All with the style you want. And reliability you can count on, so you can get more from your home every day. LG appliances, so much more. Make life easier with LG. See the latest models and savings now at LG.com.
This is something you might already know, because her life and her lore are so, and her work are so entwined together that you can't really separate them from each other. You can't be like, this is a story about my life, this is a song that I wrote. They are all one and the same. And when she's talking about it and you are hearing about it from her, you could, for example, and people do this on TikTok all the time, turn anything she says into a metaphor about capitalism or parenting or creativity or Pennsylvania. The smallest thing that she will say will get like blown up and taken out of proportion. But here he's saying, I understand, I see why people think that impulse, but on a human to human basis, I think this is really what's motivating her.
Once upon a time, she was a loser.
And she'll never let
us
forget.
It's that simple. No, and it's like, this even kind of came up in her wedding vows to Travis. When she was talking about how Travis was that guy in high school who would go over and like sit with the unpopular kids. And the kids were,
this new information to me.
well, buckle in. So you know, she was talking about how Travis was that guy in high school who would go over, here's the unpopular kids, these are the kids that are bullied, and he would go sit with them and like never made fun of them and would try to, you know, make their days better. She's saying he's such a great guy and he's so nice. And she says, he's the kind of person that I wish I had been able to know when I was younger, because I was the freak. She didn't say that. I'm paraphrasing that part, but like, that's
but
what
loser
she's
is a big
implying.
Part of her psychology.
But she really said, is. If I was in high school with Travis, he would have said, look at that loser girl over there. Let me buy her chocolate milk. Is essentially what she's saying. But it's like high school, pause. Lest we forget, we have very real tangential evidence. She was Miss Hot Thing in high school. Mm-hmm. It's called a little documentary where we see her and her choker and her Starbucks and her heel flip-flops and her capri pants and her flip-flopping into school with her Starbucks. So there's that. But middle school, I 100% believe she was a freaky deaky. I think it's a canon event for a lot of girls. I remember when I was in middle school, this is hilarious. I was strangely tall for a long time because I got to 5'2".
You were
early.
The freak.
I was the freak. No, and it's like when that happens to you, when you're the big, tall, like chubby little freak who's bigger than all the girls, it stays with you your whole life. It never goes away. Sometimes I still feel it, like even like among girls who are like Amazons, I'm the monster on the hill. I'm still like that person. So I think that people have been really criticizing Taylor for this. Like, people were really making fun of her for bringing up high school again in your wedding vows. But it's like, but this is a motivating thing. This is like it's in there, man. I don't know. It's just kind of like part of her. I'm used to it.
It is part of her. She's been bringing it up for years. It doesn't surprise me that it comes up at the wedding. But yeah, great insight he was making here. I thought that was like such a good clock. And you wouldn't get that clock if he didn't get the space to talk to her and then analyze about it in an article. So then the article continues. So is it unfair to categorize Swift as calculating? Maybe. And particularly if you view that term as exclusively pejorative, but calling her guileless would be even crazier. Swift views her lyrics as the most important part of her art. The lyrics are what I want you to focus on, she asserts. So we spend some time parsing specific passages from specific songs. Here is how she dissects the conjecture over Bad Blood, a single universally assumed to be about Katy Perry. You never say who your songs are about, but you can see that if enough people believe something, it essentially becomes fact. So by not saying who you're writing about, aren't you allowing public consensus to dictate the meaning of your work? If everyone assumes that Bad Blood is about a specific person, aren't you allowing the culture to create a fact about your life? No one would ever be able to ask her a question like this now. It's crazy.
No, he's trying to get her tea.
He's trying to get her, and she's surprised. You're in a Rolling Stone interview, and the writer says, who is that song about? That sounds like a really intense moment from your life, and you sit there, and you know you're on good terms with your ex-boyfriend, and you don't want him or his family to think you're firing shots at him, so you say, that was about losing a friend, and that's basically all you say. But then people cryptically tweet about what you meant. I never said anything that would point a finger in the direction of one specific person, and I can sleep at night knowing that. I knew the song would be assigned to a person, and the easiest mark was someone who I didn't want to be labeled with this song. It was not a song about heartbreak. It was a song about the loss of a friendship.
She's honestly, she's deluded. I never said that. And it's like, he clocks her tea later on, and he says, but yes, you did. But I don't think he says that to her face. But he says, but nobody thinks that song is about a guy. And he's right. I wouldn't have thought that if I heard it. It's one of those songs where it's like, if you've been through something similar, you know immediately, this is about no romantic relationship. This is a betrayal of the platonic variety. This is so obvious. But then she says, but they would have. So I don't necessarily care who people think it's about. I just needed to divert them away from the easiest target. Sidebar, the concept of I need to protect Harry Styles at all costs. Meanwhile,
where is that coming from? He put me on a snowmobile and put my life in jeopardy.
Stuff. She says so much other stuff on the album. Yeah,
he almost killed me.
That case wide open. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. So it's like, what is this? I needed to protect Harry from these accusations that Bad Blood could be about him. But She continues, listen to the song. It doesn't point to any one person or any one situation. But if you'd listened to my previous four albums, you would think this was about a guy who broke my heart. And nothing could be further from the truth. It was important to show that losing friendships can be just as damaging to a person as losing a romantic relationship. You are cracked in the head.
That's all well and good. But did you have to do I'm assaulting the Katy Perry Nation to prove that? This is what he's asking you. He's asking you, aren't you letting – he's really asking about? Aren't you letting the hounds go after someone? Isn't this you setting the Swifties on people by not being clear and direct about what you're talking about?
Well, as long as it's Harry Styles. As long as it's not Harry Styles, she could care less. She could care less. And then he says, the writer says, now there are more than a few molecules of bullshit in this
clocker
response. When Swift says, and that's basically all you say, she is neglecting to mention that she also told the reporter that the disharmony stemmed from a business conflict and that the individual in question tried to sabotage an arena tour by hiring away some of her employees. These details dramatically reduce the pool of potential candidates. Yet consider this strategy's larger brilliance. In order to abort the possibility of a rumor she did not want, she propagated the existence of a different rumor that offered the added value of making the song more interesting. She said, I will blow Katy Perry up at any opportunity if it means that Harry sleeps peacefully another night.
She also visually depicted her killing her in a music video. Like, that is what's so – the cognitive dissonance that Taylor is experiencing here, I think she was really caught off guard by that question. This is giving – I didn't prep an answer, so – I'm going to do my magical thinking and protect Harry Styles at all costs. Girl, you were saying, I hate him before this came out. You were saying, I'm going to make fun of your accent on the Grammys. I'm going to tell everyone that I hate you. I'm going to avoid seeing you at parties. Like, there was this compulsion to be Harry Styles' number one soldier is a strange and not true lie.
Well, I guess she's thinking being Harry Styles' number one soldier is better than being Katy Perry's number one op. Because I think she realized that there's a disconnect between here's my collection of female friends, and this is my female empowerment album, and this is my single girl era, and this is my era of feminism, and I'm woken up, and I'm never going back. There's a disconnect between all that and watch me kill this bitch I hate. I think she kind of realized that and was like, it's about something else. It really isn't about all that. And it's like, but it is though. And it's okay if you wanted Katy Perry to go down hard. We got to watch that in real time. Everybody saw the Witness era.
It happened.
Everybody heard Swish Swish. It happened. And it's because of you. And you're saying she said, I sleep like a goddamn baby every night.
That was crazy. No, it was crazy. And this persisted because who ended up apologizing to who? It's one of the most insane cases of Tay Voodoo in the history of the world. And it's still going.
I left off this really interesting last line. He says, Swift can manufacture the kind of mythology that used to happen to Carly Simon by accident. Yes.
Catching she has way more of a hand in the pot. Messy boots. Messy boots.
Messy boots. Messy boots.
How would anybody ever know? The song isn't specific. Yeah, but when you say it was another pop star who hired dancers out from under me, there's like maybe at that period of time, four people it could be. We know it's not Rihanna. We know it's not Beyonce. And we know that three of your dancers went to go work with Katy Perry. It's like publicly available information.
It was too easy. We had that figured out in 10 seconds. As readers of the Rolling Stone article, we knew immediately. I remember where I was when I read that article. I remember where I was when the lightning struck and I realized, holy shit, this is about Katy Perry. And she's acting like.
I'm not proud to say it, but at 17 years old, I was in Leah, the dancer who got poached, comments and saying, how dare you betray Taylor?
Say it. How dare you betray Taylor?
And she said, you have no idea what you're talking about. And I said, yes, I do. I read the Rolling Stone article.
She responded. Oh,
yeah,
no.
We got into a back and forth.
Yes, I do.
Because I had met her. Katy had just performed in Singapore, and I had met all of her dancers, and they came out and talked to us for a while. So she followed me back on Instagram, which is lame, by the way. I was like 16. You're a dancer. But this was back in the day, you know, like 2014, right. 2013.
Yeah.
Social media
really
was different.
Social media, yeah.
But we got locked into an argument back and forth. And this is where she said that Taylor didn't hang out with the dancers, and she wasn't nice. and Katie was nice.
Right.
All that to so say, you say, I found my target. It worked.
Period. So yeah, but Taylor sleeps well every single
night. Taylor sleeps perfectly at night. The article continues, speaking of accidents, here's some breaking news. They happened to Taylor Swift, too. She believes the most consequential accident of her professional life was when Kanye West famously stormed the stage during her acceptance speech at the 2009 VMAs. I'm surprised when she brings this up unprompted because she has barely addressed the incident in 5 years, aside from the comically undisguised song, Innocent. But fences have been mended and feelings have been felt. All this summer, at this summer's VMAs, Swift warmly presented West with the Video Vanguard Trophy. She'll probably serve as the Secretary of the Interior when he becomes president. Swift was lauded for handling his 09 intrusion with grace and composure, but her personal memories of the event dwell on bewilderment. When West first jumped on stage, Swift assumed that he was about to make a special presentation honoring her to be the first country artist to ever win a VMA. She truly had no idea what was transpiring. When the crowd started booing, I thought they were booing because they also believed I didn't deserve the award. That's where the hurt come from. I went backstage and cried. Then I had to stop crying and perform 5 minutes later. I told myself I had to perform, and I tried to convince myself that maybe this wasn't that big of a deal. But that was the most happenstance thing to ever happen in my career. And to now be in a place where Kanye and I respect each other, that's one of my favorite things that has ever happened in my career. And it lasted for about 6 months.
Everything about this whole portion is so 2015. The concept of Kanye winning for president and winning, the concept of Taylor and Kanye being friends and her thinking, oh, yeah, it's finally all happening. It's finally all happening.
It's finally
he
happening.
He respects me. Oh, no! Taylor. It's almost Taylor, hard to Taylor, read. You're Taylor. Like, you wish you could jump into the text and like go back to this moment of her saying this and get into the lunch and say, Taylor, I'm from the future. Let call Kanye right now and say, never call me again.
Put it in writing, sadly, saying that you did not make this bitch famous. Yes. Put that in writing.
But sadly, you cannot do that.
So the article ends with the writer really trying to get Taylor to say that she's lonely. So Swift analyzes her friendship so often that I eventually ask what seems like an obvious question. Does she ever feel lonely? She responds by literally talking about friends. I'm around so much, she says, massive amounts of people. I do a meet and greet every night on tour, and it's 150 people. Before that, it's a radio meet and greet with 40 people. After the show, it's 30 or 40 more people. So when I go home and turn on the TV and I've got Monica and Chandler and Ross and Rachel and Phoebe and Joey on a Friends marathon, I don't feel lonely. I've just been on stage for hours talking to 60,000 people about my feelings. That's so much social stimulation. When I get home, there is not one part of me that wishes I was around other people. This is understandable. Still, I note something any musician obsessed with self-awareness would undoubtedly recognize. In the retrospective context of a hypothetical Behind the Music episode, this anecdote would be framed as depressing. It would paint the portrait of a super famous entertainer spending her day emoting to thousands of strangers, only to return home to an empty house and the one-way company of two-dimensional characters. Does she not see the irony? Oh, she sees it, but that doesn't mean that it's real. There is such a thing as having enough, she says in her non-TV voice. You might think a meet and greet with 150 people sounds sad because maybe you think I'm forced to do it, but you would be surprised. A meaningful conversation doesn't mean that conversation has to last an hour. A meet and greet might sound weird to someone who's never done it, but after 10 years, you learn to appreciate happiness when it happens and that happiness is rare and fleeting and you're not entitled to it. You know, during the first few years of your career, the only thing anyone says to you is enjoy this. That's all they ever tell you. And I finally know how to do that. Taylor Swift is 25, but she's older than you. Girl, lots of truths being spoken here.
Lots of truths being spoken here. What kind of kills me is this denial. The extreme. I don't think it's that she doesn't realize it. I think she's denying it. She's like, come on, I talk to people all the time. I have so many friends, and they're my real friends,
but also,
too.
Calvin Harris was mentioned at this period of time. He was in the picture. So what is this going home alone coming from?
Well,
she's not immediately like, my boyfriend,
calling
my
someone
man.
Right now? Isn't there somebody that I should be calling? Oh my God, that was all you wanted. That was all you
wanted.
What
I will give her,
though,
that
was all you worked towards.
We know this on a very much smaller scale, but when I do sound check, show, meet and greet, I want to go home and be alone. I don't want to be around anybody else. I want silence. I want food.
No.
I want my bed.
It's like that Niall tweet where he says, had a great night last night with everybody, but now I don't want to talk to anybody. Do not try to contact me today.
That's it.
That was me all the time. Don't try to contact me. I'm gone. I'm boop. You never saw me.
No, she's right about
but
that.
But it's like,
but if he's trying to get her to say it's lonely.
And she won't admit it because she's still not supposed to complain. This is still like the everything in my life is perfect and I would never complain about this thing that I wanted for all my life. I would never complain about being famous or anything that being famous really has done to me other than the sexism and the slut shaming, which is just like fair game at that point. But she, it's like she, you can't even complain about the fact that, you know, there is something kind of, I don't know.
Isolating?
It's like, are these real connections? Are these real connections? Is standing on a stage in front of 60,000 people and repeating the same speech that you say every single night about clean, is that real connection or is that rehearsal? You know what I mean?
Yeah, this is a great idea. I do like the idea about the meet and greet though for her, where she was like, a meaningful conversation doesn't have to last an hour. Cause I've definitely felt that in our meet and greets. Like sometimes we'll have a quick but very impactful conversation on me. So I understand her point there, but I think she is still in a place of, I have to perform gratitude all the time or else it will get taken away from me. And also at this point, nothing that catastrophically bad had happened to her for her to complain about.
Not yet.
So not instead, yet, we're gonna talk but about soon.
Taylor Swift's reputation.
Well, that was our episode of today's Tay Rewind. If you guys like this kind of in-depth textual analysis, there are quite a few long form interviews that Taylor has done out there that are interesting. I think the New Yorker one from 2011 that gives a lot of tea on the Andrea and Scott of it all, I think that might be a next place for us to go. But let us know how you feel about this Tay Rewind. Do you want more? Go to patreon.com/astrologist for more if you do. Now, thank you.